From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Jane Goodall may know more about mankind's nearest relatives than anyone else on Earth. For more than 30 years, Goodall's been studying the chimpanzees of East Africa. On this edition of Fresh Air, Jane Goodall tells us what we humans can learn from apes. Also today, we meet actor Paul Winfield. He plays Judge Laron Little in the movie Presumed Innocent. And Maureen Corrigan tells us what it's like to live in one of the world's greatest tourist cities when all the tourist attractions close down. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The UN Security Council remains deadlocked over the text of a resolution condemning the killing of 21 Palestinians by Israeli police on Monday. The 15-member body met until dawn and then postponed any further talks until tomorrow. Jim Zeroli reports from New York.
British Ambassador Sir David Hannay, who presides over the council this month, met individually today with some members to try to break the impasse. The 15 members have agreed to condemn the killings and to send a three-person mission from the Secretary General's office to investigate the incident. But they disagree over how broad the team's mandate should be. The seven non-aligned countries want the mission to recommend ways to protect Palestinians who are, quote, under Israeli occupation. But it is not clear whether the U.S. is Israel's longtime ally will support such wording. For National Public Radio, this is Jim Zeroli in New York.
Earlier today, police fought with Palestinian protesters in several Jerusalem neighborhoods. Security forces used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse about 300 Palestinians who tried to march from a nearby refugee camp through a major thoroughfare. Police also drove about 150 demonstrators away from the Temple Mount using tear gas. The Temple Mount was the site on which 21 Palestinians were killed by Israeli security forces on Monday. The Israeli government called on Jews to reassert control over the Western Wall, Judaism's holiest site, by massing there today for the end of a religious festival. About 60 federal employees protested in front of the White House today to let President Bush know they want what they call a fair and equitable budget that won't hurt working people. Mary Carlin has this report.
The federal workers chanting and holding signs like, "Save our jobs," are still employed. But last weekend, many of their offices were closed when the federal government ran out of money. The Reverend Jesse Jackson joined the union workers in the march, and he called on President Bush to work with Congress to get an acceptable budget compromise.
Save the workers, tax the rich, and be fair. Yeah!
Jackson says a domestic summit conference at the White House to deal with farmers and the working poor is needed. He says only the top 10% of Americans have enjoyed lower taxes since 1977. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Carlin in Washington.
Some 50,000 people demonstrated today in Prague to demand the confiscation of all property held by the Czechoslovak Communist Party. The protests were sparked by recent comments by the National Party leader, who called on communists to exert influence on the labor union movement. Anti-communist demonstrators demanded his resignation and called on the government to seize all communist property. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 43 points today to close at 2,365. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Terry Gross is in Louisville, Kentucky today, helping station WFPL celebrate their 40th anniversary. On the shores of Lake Tanganyika in the community of Gombe in East Africa live Melissa and Mike and old Flo and Fegan. The intimate details of their lives have been documented in articles in National Geographic and in books written by my guest, Jane Goodall. Goodall is one of the world's leading researchers on chimpanzees. She studied the same community of chimps in Gombe for the past 30 years. She's observed births and deaths, relationships and wars. She was the first person to see chimpanzees eating meat, which contradicted the previously held view that they were vegetarians. Her 30-year project in Gombe is the longest unbroken study of an animal species in the wild. These days, Goodall is frequently called away from Africa to lobby and testify. She is working for the Humane Treatment of Chimps in zoos and medical labs, and she hopes to have them reclassified as an endangered species. Jane Goodall has a new book about her 30 years with the chimpanzees of Gombe called Through a Window. Goodall has given names to these chimps, and she sees strong personalities and human-like traits in the animals. When Goodall began her study in 1960, the scientific community didn't recognize that animals had minds or personalities.
You see, right at the beginning, in the time of Darwin, for example, everybody just assumed that animals had minds and personalities, including the scientists. And then we had the American behaviorist school, started by Watson, who taught that animals were just machines, little bundles of stimuluses and responses. And that has been very hard to overcome, to return to the more common sense view, which all children know, that animals have minds and personalities. They are harder things to subject to cold scientific scrutiny than the rest of it.
Is there a danger at all of anthropomorphizing the chimpanzees you study? I guess seeing human qualities where they might not exist. Is that a temptation that you have to deal with?
Well, it's not a temptation, it's a fact. And I think here again, you see, science has been very quick to recognize the incredible similarities in the chimpanzee and human brain, the anatomy of the brain, the structure of the central nervous system, and all the other amazing physiological similarities. So it sort of stands to reason that you would find similarities in the emotions and the expressions of the emotions and in certain kinds of behavior and in intellect. And as far as intellect's concerned, then we now have a lot of nice hard scientific information from studies in psychology labs, which do indeed show that chimps have all kinds of intellectual abilities that we used to consider unique to humans. And so we should be looking for human traits in chimpanzees and then sort of investigating them as much as we can to find out whether that's true.
After 30 years of working in Tanzania and in Gombe, who do the chimps think that you are?
I sometimes wonder, but basically, in the chimpanzees' world, the most important other living beings are other chimpanzees, particularly your family members, or if you're a young male, the top-ranking male is a very important figure in your life. And then after other chimps, there are, I suppose, the prey animals, because they're good for food, and baboons. Young baboons and young chimpanzees play, and there are humans, and I think we're just one other part of their natural life.
How close do you get to them and their life, and is there even a kind of physical distance that you need to keep in order to keep that kind of, even that scientific objectivity?
Well, we try to keep a distance. It's not only from any scientific objectivity, it's because we want to interfere with their natural behavior as little as possible. Also, they're subject to catching our human diseases, so it's not good to get too close. However, the young chimps will often move across that barrier. They want to come and inspect and poke and stuff like that, and you try to ignore it. If it persists, you try to gently move away.
How do you spend your days when you are in Gombe in Tanzania? And I imagine those days are fewer and far between at this point.
Yeah, it's very sad how little time I'm able to spend there. But when I do get there, then I totally immerse myself in the chimps, getting up early, going to where they nested the night before, waiting for them to wake up, and following them as much of the day as I can. It's not always possible to follow all day because the country is pretty tough and rugged, and unless you're there all the time, you know, you actually have to get fit. It's difficult to wriggle about on your tummy up and down steep slopes unless you're in good training.
Well, have you found over 30 years that it's harder and harder to kind of go where they go?
Not if I'm there for a reasonable length of time. You can get pretty fit in a week, but some of my trips recently have not been longer than a week. And then, yes, then it's harder, obviously. I mean, you know, one can't do quite what one did at 20 anymore.
Is it just a coincidence that you and Diane Fossey, you, of course, studying the chimpanzees, and Diane Fossey studying gorillas in their natural habitat, that you're women, and that women in certain ways have a temperament suited to the science of observation?
Louis Leakey specifically chose women. He felt that women were more patient and made better observers. And it's interesting, I've thought about this a lot. At the time when I was selected, it was a time when traditionally the male made the family and provided, and the woman became a wife and a mother. So that at that time, there was far less pressure on young women for making careers. So you could sit there, and as long as Louis Leakey provided the money, you could observe the chimps forever.
What variation and what differences did you observe in the child-raising techniques? And there are two mothers whose lives you have watched and whose offspring you've watched as well, and this is Flo and Passion. But I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the different kind of mothers that they were.
Well, they, as you say, were very, very different. Flo was... Well, to start with, both of them, both Flo and Passion, were high-ranking in the female hierarchy, and they both were very assertive and could on occasions be aggressive. But other than that, they were very, very different, certainly as mothers. Flo was affectionate. She was very tolerant of her youngsters. She was not too restrictive. She allowed them to move out and explore, but she kept a very watchful eye on them and rescued them quickly if they got into trouble. She was very supportive, too. And so she developed these very, very close bonds with her various children. Passion, on the other hand, was particularly with her first infant, Pom. She was very cold, extremely restrictive. She would get up and move away before Pom could properly walk, leaving the little infant on the ground whimpering. And it was only gradually, as Pom grew older, that Passion became a better mother to her.
So you've really seen then the kind of progression of that kind of mothering. I'm interested in what kind of then adults these children turned out to be.
Right, that's what's so truly fascinating, the tremendous importance that we see of the nature of early experience in the chimpanzee society, because we find indeed that Flo's youngsters grew up to be very assertive, self-confident. They attained high ranks, both males and females. And Fifi has turned into exactly the same kind of mother. She has the same maternal characteristics. She's the most successful female reproductively, and she also is high-ranking, assertive, and like Flo, has very good relaxed relationships with the adult males. Pom, by contrast, Passion's daughter, never became very assertive. She was a poor mother, like Passion, although not quite as heartless. And she never developed good relationships with the adult males. In fact, after her mother died, Pom, I think because she really didn't have a good place in the female hierarchy, emigrated and joined a neighboring group.
And in chimpanzee communities, are there mother substitutes or even a system of foster care, adoption, that kind of thing, where if a child is abandoned by their mother, that another mother will take over?
It's normally, if a mother dies, that the elder brother or sister will take care of the infant. And providing the infant's over 3 years and not totally dependent on milk, then that child has a chance of survival. However, some youngsters, even 5 years or more, become so depressed upon the loss of their mother. They show signs like clinical depression in grieving human youngsters and simply don't make it. The immune system is weakened and they fall sick to some disease and die. We've had probably the most touching story of all at Gombe over the 30 years was when a little infant called Mel lost his mother. He was 3 years old. He had no elder brother or sister, and we all thought for sure that he would die. But what happened was truly remarkable. He was adopted by a 12-year-old adolescent male who, as far as we know, was absolutely not related to the family, had never spent much time with them. And yet this young male, that's like a human youth of about 15 or 16, he carried this little infant, he waited for him, he shared his food, he shared his nest at night, and he even ran the risk of being beaten up himself to run and gather up his little charge if he got in the way of the socially roused adult males, and saved his life.
Is this then compassion? I mean, is that what you observed?
this clearly is at least the kind of behavior from which true human compassion has sprung, but I would label it unhesitatingly compassion and altruism.
My guest today is Jane Goodall. This is the 30th year that she has spent studying and living with the chimpanzees of Gombe, Tanzania. Goodall's earlier book, In the Shadow of Man, told of her first 10 years living in Gombe. She has now brought the story up to the present in her new book, Through a Window. We're going to talk after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Jane Goodall is my guest today. How do mother chimpanzees treat their sons differently from their daughters? And can you see them preparing them for a different kind of life?
No, I think it's actually mostly in the child. We find that the young males from an early age tend to be more prone to exploring, to leaving the mother earlier. They're fascinated from a very young age by the adult males, watching what they do and very often imitating them. They're fascinated by females in estrus, that's females who develop these pale pink swellings on their rumps. And the young female tends to be slightly less adventurous, slightly more gentle, slightly less violent in her play. Certainly there's a big difference at weaning, where the young male is likely to throw violent tantrums when he's rejected by the mother. The female is more likely to try and groom her way closer and closer to the forbidden nipple and seize a little suck.
Do you see the older males then playing any part in kind of initiating, I don't want to use that word too strongly, but initiating the younger males into male society?
Well, they serve that role, because when the young male starts to leave his mother, which he does between the ages of 8 and 10 usually, not totally leave her, but spend short periods of time, which gradually increase, away from her, he chooses to follow the adult males. And he'll very often choose one particular male and, in a way, sort of hero worship, in quotes, and imitate what that male does. And this is, of course, very beneficial for him, because if he stayed with his mother, he wouldn't learn the sort of things he needs to learn to be an effective adult male. He's got to learn about patrolling the boundaries of the community territory. He's got to learn about perpetrating attacks on neighbors to keep the territory secure or even to enlarge it. He's got to learn about some of the kinds of hunting that's usually done only by the males, like hunting young baboons or bush pigs. So if he just stayed with his mother, he couldn't learn those things.
You say that you've observed females, and this is, I guess, in courtship, that they actually seem to prefer some males to others. But I'm curious about what choice she has in the matter over courtship, whether it's anything besides just the timing of it.
She doesn't have that much choice. These young females who move back and forth from one community to another, of course, are helping to spread, helping to prevent too much inbreeding, because they may transfer permanently to a neighboring community. And sometimes they seem to do that because the males of their own community aren't too interested in them. Mm. But for the most part, when a female comes into estrus, she can be surrounded by most or all of the males of her community and mated by all of them one after the other. She can, to some extent, avoid certain males, particularly by approaching a higher-ranking male and hoping that his presence will inhibit the approach of the undesirable suitor. But unfortunately for the females, almost any male, if he's got any sort of social skill, can persuade her to follow him away from all the other males and take her to an outlying part of the community range and there try to keep her until she is fertile.
You write about a female chimpanzee, Gigi, who was sterile, and yet she had a profound effect on the community, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, Gigi's absolutely an incredible character. She first began cycling in 1965, and regularly as clockwork, more or less, she's come into Estrus, been sexually attractive every month, and she's immensely sexually popular, so the males really cluster around her, and some females are much less popular, incidentally. But Gigi has all the sex appeal that could be desired. And because Gigi served to gather large, excitable male groups around her, then because they were gathered together, they were more likely to set off on these territorial patrols. And I think because Gigi served so often to bring them together, then there were perhaps more incidents of intercommunity aggression than there might otherwise have been. Because for a lot of time, adult males will wander about by themselves or little groups of one or two. And in that situation, they are most unlikely to go off on a patrol and engage in hostile relationships with their neighbors.
How has the violence and even the cannibalism that you observed in this colony of chimpanzees, how has that changed your understanding of who you thought chimpanzees were when you first started your research?
Well, I used to think, you know, as I spent month after month and saw more and more behaviors that so closely resembled ours, like the nonverbal communication where they touch, kiss, embrace, pat one another, hold hands, all the same sort of gestures as we use in the same contexts. And I watched these amazing long-term family relationships, the supportive relationships between mothers and youngsters and siblings. As I watched all this, I thought, yeah, they're very like us, but they're nicer. Yeah, they have some flare-ups between community members, and the males sometimes fight for dominance, but it's over quickly and it doesn't mean much. And then when I saw the first really brutal assaults by adult males on neighboring individuals, male or female alike, and saw the cannibalism, then I was shocked, I was saddened, but I realized that very sadly this makes them even more like us than I thought before.
Jane Goodall is my guest today. Her new book is called Through a Window. How would you say the chimpanzees of Gombe are threatened by either or tourism or development? How has that habitat changed in 30 years?
Oh, when I first got to Gombe, I could climb up to the peaks of the rift escarpment overlooking Lake Tanganyika, and all around I could see chimp habitats stretching out. Today, cultivation has come right up to the boundaries of the national park, and the three chimpanzee communities within the 30-square-mile reserve are now virtually isolated, well, completely isolated, from other chimpanzee populations, which isn't a very good lookout for the future. And in addition, tourism has been permitted, not too well controlled up until now. Now it's better. And chimps are susceptible to all human diseases. And because we'd been studying these chimps so long, because they were so habituated, this meant that they could get much too close to the tourists and run the risk of infection. And there are about over 1,000 fishermen camped along the shores of the lake in the national park, so that the chimps run the risk of contacting their diseases too. However, I think because I've used Tanzanians from local villages around the park to do the day-to-day observation, you know, taking a real central part in the research, using 8mm video cameras, they are caring about the chimps just as I am. They tell their families, and there's no way we get poaching at Gombe. So from that point of view, the chimps are very, very lucky compared to those in most of the rest of Africa.
If they are going to be cut off and isolated from other chimpanzee communities, what will happen, I guess, to their community? Will it develop traits that become rather idiosyncratic, do you think?
I suspect so. That's why I said that the view in the long term isn't so good, unless maybe sometime along the road we would manipulate nature, maybe introduce a couple of young females from different genetic stock. I don't know, but in the long run, I think the 150 chimps there is not a large enough genetic pool to sustain a population so tiny.
If chimpanzees are genetically and physiologically similar to us, do they have a place, do you think, in biomedical research?
Well, they are used in biomedical research. They are principally used in infectious disease research, studying the nature of the disease or its cure. And there is a lot of controversy, even among the scientists who are doing this research, as to whether chimpanzees are useful or not. However, although I'm not in a position to say whether chimps are useful or not, I am in a position to say that the conditions under which they're maintained in most labs in this country are absolutely, totally inadequate to imprison our closest living relative.
And how should they be changed? How would you like these chimpanzees then to live in laboratories?
Well, first, let me explain to those who don't know the complete horror that I've felt having watched them in the wild for 30 years on going into labs where the adult chimpanzees are confined in cages alone of 5 foot by 5 foot, 7 foot high, and that can be for a life of up to 50 years. And in those bleak cells, there is nothing, just steel bars. And, you know, they haven't committed a crime. We wouldn't keep our most hardened criminals that way. So we need much, much larger cages. We never should singly house chimps, and the virologists have actually published papers now saying that it isn't necessary. They should have plenty of objects to enrich their lives. They should have challenges. There should be some way they can control parts of their environment, even if it's only pressing one button gives you a drink and another button gives you food or a different kind of food.
But they need that kind of stimulation.
They do. I mean, I can assure you that a small chimpanzee child and a small human child pre-speech are really almost identical. I mean, they have the same desperate need for reassurance and love and contact. And to see them as I have seen them in this country, two-year-old chimps in cages measuring 22 inches by 22 inches and 2 foot high with nothing else in them, stacked up in quarantine, that is just outrageous.
What is left to do in Gombe, and I'm interested in how much time you can spend there now and what projects you're working on?
Well, the time I spend there is decreasing all the time, and it's partly from trying to raise levels of awareness about what chimps are here and in Europe. It's partly fighting for conservation in other parts of Africa where chimps are going so quickly. The challenge for learning about chimpanzee behavior, the greatest excitement, I think, lies in the fact that in different parts of Africa, chimps have different cultural traditions, different kind of tool usings, different use of inborn gestures in communication, different calls, even like a different dialect. And if we're not careful, we shall never learn a quarter of that fascinating cultural diversity, because the populations are vanishing. I mean, we'll never learn all of it because so many chimps have already gone.
Jane Goodall's new book is Through a Window, My 30 Years with the Chimpanzees of Gombe. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. actor Paul Winfield's been nominated for 2 Emmys and an Academy Award, and he's in one of this summer's biggest movies. So how come no one recognizes him on the street? Coming up, we give Paul Winfield some exposure. And millions of visitors from around the world come to Washington, D.C. every year. Unfortunately for commentator Maureen Corrigan, her visitors came last week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In the ongoing budget controversy, President Bush appeared today to throw cold water on a GOP proposal to raise taxes for the wealthy in exchange for a cut in the capital gains tax rate. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
After meeting with Mr. Bush, ranking House Republican members said the president was prepared to sign on to a plan that would raise the tax rate on the wealthy from 28% to 31% if Democrats went along with a 15% cut in the capital gains rate. But soon thereafter, the president said he was pessimistic the trade-off would work.
Fine. I think it's a waste of time because I just don't think it can get through both houses of Congress.
Why not?
Because it's just not going to get through both houses of Congress.
White House aides say the president was consistent, but the sharp pessimism added to the impression of confusion about what the president proposes to cut the federal deficit. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Capitol Hill, the House failed to override a presidential veto of a bill to cut back on textile and shoe imports, turning aside pleas for protection from unfair foreign competition. Supporters of the measure led the vote by 275 to 152, but lacked 10 votes needed of the two-thirds required to override. In South Africa, the African National Congress today revealed details of confidential talks with the government as a protest against recent government actions. John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Ever since he came out of prison 8 months ago, Nelson Mandela has described President F.W. de Klerk as a man of integrity. Today that changed. In a printed statement, the ANC said that events of the past week have forced Nelson Mandela to call into question the president's integrity. The ANC said that on Monday, Mandela told de Klerk that the government has claimed that Mandela agreed to a security crackdown known as Operation Fist, when in fact, de Klerk did not tell Mandela what was planned. Mandela also said the government has made repeated policy decisions which contradicted agreements with the ANC or preempted decisions which are supposed to be made by joint committees of the ANC and the government. The ANC's action does not reflect a desire to abandon the peace process yet, but it does represent growing frustration that despite numerous meetings and apparent agreements, the government has moved very slowly in allowing political prisoners to leave prison and placed obstacles that delay the return of exiles. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
And the National Airline of Kuwait says that it wants $692 million in insurance payments for airplanes and equipment seized during the Iraqi invasion. A statement from the airline also says that the company wants unspecified amounts for spare parts that are still being totaled. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 43 points to close at 2,365.10, volume 180 million shares. Declining issues led advances more than 4-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. As soon as actor Paul Winfield read Presumed Innocent, he knew he wanted the role of Judge Laron Little if the book was ever made into a movie. 3 years later, after intense lobbying, Winfield found out that he had the part. Paul Winfield has had a distinguished career on stage, on television, and in the movies. He was nominated for an Academy Award for his film debut in Sounder nearly 15 years ago. He's also been nominated twice for an Emmy Award for his role in Roots 2 and for his portrayal of Martin Luther King Jr. in the NBC special King. And this fall, Winfield will be the guest star in the first 4 episodes of L.A. Law. When we spoke recently, Paul Winfield told me why he thought the judge in Presumed Innocent would be such a wonderful part.
There are not many roles for blacks in major white motion pictures that, unless you're a sidekick or, you know, you're shooting helicopters out of the sky or those kind of things. And this was like a very grown-up adult part and a part that, and a judge and an intellectual and had some wit and power and all those wonderful things that rarely come down the pike.
How did you prepare for this part? And I assume with most parts, there's that opportunity at least to spend time with people to see how they work. And I was wondering whether you were able to do that in a courtroom to see from the judge's perspective how this works.
Well, Marty, it's very rarely done you have a chance to rehearse. But in this case, the director, Pakula, and the studio actually paid us for 3 weeks rehearsal and research and stuff. So that meant that the actors playing lawyers talked to lawyers, the ones playing DAs talked to DAs, and I had a chance to meet some very wonderful, wonderful black judges, both in Detroit and in New York. And I'm really glad I did, because not only was I able to meet some really profound people, but it was also a lot of fun. There was a judge in Detroit, Judge Lipscomb, that I had a came in for an interview, and he says, well, gee, I'm sort of running late, and I tell you what, why don't you just come out on the bench with me? I said, well, is that legal? He says, baby, it's my courtroom. I can do whatever I want. Here's a robe. Come out. So I sat right next to him, and of course he introduced me to the litigants and said, well, this is this actor from Hollywood, and mm-hmm. he's doing a research for some movie, and if any of you object to him being here, we'll transfer you to another time. Well, of course, nobody wanted to go to another court, but they just wanted, I mean, because they thought maybe they could sort of put one over on this idiot from California masquerading as a judge.
What's the perspective, though, as you're sitting up at the level, the height of a judge, what's the perspective as you look down on the courtroom?
You got it. It's a very different perspective. It's there's something that really happens. There's a kind of power that just goes with the territory. It's very awesome. I mean, in the sense that you have now power over these people's lives. You're going to make decisions that's going to affect the rest of their lives, whether it's for a traffic ticket or whatever. It makes a difference in that courtroom and that whole society, saying this is the way you're supposed to behave, and these are the people who can decide what you're supposed to do. Well, when I had a chance to do it in my own bailiwick in a soundstage in Astoria Studios in New York, and it was a very impressive set, I didn't have to sort of conjure up what it felt like. I didn't have to try to figure out what it meant. I'd been there, and it was very, very helpful.
I hear Oscar rumors or Oscar murmurings. And
oh, Marty.
There have been other, with Sounder you got an Oscar nomination, but I wonder what that means.
How is it different this time
around?
Well,
sure. It's been
I haven't
15.
Gotten it first. But, I mean, when I was, 20-something, 20, in my early 20s, and my first major picture, my first lead in a picture, and they get an Oscar nomination, I just assumed that they were going to be, this is going to happen every year. I was just on my way. It was just going to be just perfect from now on. I didn't do anything about it. I didn't do any sort of special campaigns. I didn't hire publicists. I didn't go to parties. I didn't do all those things that I now know that are somewhat important.
You have to really lobby them for the prize.
You have to really do that. And you say, well, but wait a minute. Don't I just deserve this?
Uh-huh. Apparently
no,
not.
You have to remind people, and you have to say, well, you know, he's been around for 30 years now, and he's still not in a mental institution or at Betty Ford, and he's not in a poorhouse quite yet, but he's been doing his job for 30 years and is still doing it and enjoys it. So those are the only things I really want to remind people about, but it sounds very self-serving, but it does, that Oscar does make a difference in one's career. It certainly didn't hurt Louis Gossett's. I mean, it's a much wider range of roles now than he had if he hadn't won it, I think.
So it's perhaps even more important for minority actors because of the limitation of so many of the roles.
Because so many people watch it and it gets so much attention, and finally they start putting a name with the face. I mean, it's amazing. I go down streets in major cities and white people say, didn't I go to school with you? Don't I know you from, you drive the M Street bus, right? And I said, no, I'm an actor. But black people, of course, know, hey, Paul, they know my name and they know what I've done. But for the greater, wider majority, I'm just somebody who's vaguely familiar. Mm.
My guest is actor Paul Winfield. He plays Judge Laron Little in the movie Presumed Innocent. Winfield received an Oscar nomination for his role in Sounder and an Emmy nomination for his role in Roots. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Winfield is my guest today, and he's had a long acting career and seen in Sounder and many other programs on television, and most recently in Presumed Innocent, where he played Judge Laron Little. You seem to move very easily from the stage to the screen to the television set, and you seem to be someone who has had few prejudices about what television can offer. I think some actors wouldn't deign to play to the small box and want the big screen or want the stage. But you don't seem to have those reservations.
No, I really don't. And I guess it's because I really enjoy my work. I mean, if it's an interesting part, and if it's something that is really going to stretch me and it's some sort of area of skill that I haven't really developed, or want, like doing comedy, I started briefly, in the beginning of my career, doing the Julias with Diane Carroll. I played her, one of her many suitors. But that was a big lesson for me, to probably like comedy and getting, because I was a stage actor, big and big performances, and trying to fit that performance into a little box was, and it's, and the only way you really ever find out is by doing it. And you, at least you're allowed to fail a few times, but you can't fail too many times, but I learned pretty quick, and so that's one. Just learning how to act in front of a TV camera is one thing.
Well, does that mean that your movements are smaller for the TV?
Much smaller. Yeah, it's much more intimate, and it's, you know, I've worked with actors. I mean, and I say, God, they're not doing anything, and I start acting bigger and giving more. And then I see the piece, and they're perfect. She's got just a little gleam in her eye. We're having a fight, say.
Right.
She's got just a little gleam in her eye, and I look like a raving maniac. I mean, it's because I'm...
Well, you're on a stage, aren't you, at that point?
I'm on stage, sure, right. But it is a special kind of technique. Let's put it down. Talent probably has something to do with it too, but there is a technique in all the different mediums. Some people are I've seen people wonderful on the stage, and on TV, on movies, there's just nothing there. You say, well, I don't understand. I mean, they were so good on when I saw them doing O'Neill or this, and then they're just nothing there.
You turned down a scholarship to the Yale Drama School, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
And I guess for many aspiring actors, that would be some kind of a ticket.
Well, you know, it wasn't, it was not a full scholarship. It was just books and tuition. Now, when I left, I got another scholarship to where I had relatives in the University of Portland. But when I left, my parents gave me a $50 bill and said, good luck and goodbye.
How old were you?
I was 18, 19, you know. And the brochure, I remember them saying, well, you know, it's an hour away by train to New York and blah, 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 and it's at Yale. And I said, well, you know, but I'd have to buy clothes, I'd have to have a part-time job, and I'd also have to keep up my academic side. And also in the theater department, you have rehearsals and performances at night, so when do you have this part-time job? Mm-hmm. And when do you buy clothes and food and books and all that stuff? So it wasn't that hard a decision. And also, it was 3,000 miles away from home and anybody I knew. And that part was pretty scary. But basically, it was economic, that sort of reason I turned it down. If it had been a little bit more,
you might have been.
I might have done it. But living with aunts and uncles, and they could sort of slip me $10 occasionally, helped a lot.
When did you actually begin to act? And was this something that happened in high school or even before that?
Well, as I said, we were not very wealthy, in fact, very poor. And so we moved around a lot. Mm-hmm. because my dad was in construction, and wherever the job was, that's where we went. So it was like, you know, you'd go to a new school, and you'd have to start making friends all over again. And sometimes, after a while, it became harder. It was easier just to sort of escape into books. I mean, they became my best friends, and I knew they'd be waiting at the next library. That sort of fantasy life that you could, without dealing with real people and the things you do as a grown-up.
And but I guess also the heartache of leaving friends.
And leaving friends and having to start that process all over again is, it just became easier to just read a book. And, but in my senior year in junior high school, I was cast in a play. I got into a play somehow. And I had one, I had several lines, but one line that really sort of suddenly brought down the house. I said, I still remember it to this day. I said, "Jumpin' Jehoshaphat." And somehow, for some reason, it just stopped the show. Uh-huh. And for the rest of that summer, particularly young ladies would come up to me and says, "Hey, weren't you that guy in that play?" I said, "Yeah." "Say that line for me. Just say it one more time." I said, "Okay. Jumpin' Jehoshaphat." And we would laugh. And he said, "You know, we're giving a party this Saturday. Maybe you'd like to." What an entree.
Yeah.
I mean, what an easy way to get attention and to get friends. So I stuck with it.
So does it still work now?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, Lauren Little, and the judge, is actually the same guy who's doing Jumpin' Jehoshaphat.
Yeah.
It gets that same attention. It gets that same uncritical affection.
Actor Paul Winfield is my guest today. I'm wondering, and you kind of alluded this to this before, about the limited number of roles to black actors. And I understand that in a Tennessee Williams play, The Glass Menagerie, you had to play it in whiteface. Mm. And I guess, was this to somehow please the producers? Or first of all, when was all this?
This was in, the early 70s. It was a federally funded project to do plays. There were three theaters, one in New Orleans, one in Connecticut, and one in Los Angeles, to do plays for every high school student in that county over a year, period of 3 years. I was hired in the first company to in L.A., the first year, rather, to and we would do the classics, Molière, Tennessee Williams, whatever. But they bus in these kids at 10 o'clock in the morning to see something touching like Glass Menagerie. But I think we were 10 actors who were hired. I was the first production cause. Andre Gregory was the first artistic director in L.A. Put Tartuffe in Spanish California, and Louis Gossett played the Tartuffe. George Gaines and played Orgon, and it was cowboys and Indians, basically, in a Spanish setting. Well, the kids loved it, but the school teacher said, "Well, wait a minute, where are all these periwigs and things? I mean, it's not the same as in the book." He said, "Well, it never is the same. That's why you put it on a stage, to sort of bring it to life." But when I was cast as a gentleman caller, that really broke the camel's back. They just said, wait a minute. For a son to bring home a black man for his crippled sister, and his mother is a Southern belle, it would be an act of cruelty. It's not nothing kind about this. And he said that would maybe destroy the fabric of the play. Andre Gregory was fired immediately. Gregory Peck, who was on the board, said, "Well, he's the best actor for the part." I said, "Well, yes, but..." He said, well, if the only objection is the color of his skin, let's change the color of his skin. So out of his own pocket, he paid. I went to 20th Century Fox every morning. They invented a new makeup, Ben Nye, had a Winfield opaque. It sort of blocked out my color, had a nose, contact lenses.
They made you a new nose?
A new nose, yes, to sort of make a sort of more aquiline. Put on this very thin base that sort of took out all the color. And then they painted on a new face on my face. But it was, and it apparently worked. The first, I mean, when my parents, I didn't tell my parents about this, and they came to see it, and they didn't know it was me until they heard me talk for a while. But the point was, I knew how white people acted. I mean, I've been around them all my life, for Christ's sake, and I knew this character very well. So I felt I should have had the opportunity to play him and interpret him. That's what my job is. So we did. And after the play, we would take off the wig, take out the contact lenses, take off the nose, take off the makeup in front of the kids, and then we would discuss it, why we had to do this, if it was necessary. And they had a lot of feedback, a lot of interesting thoughts about it.
Are there more or less roles, would you say, for black actors from the beginning of your career to now? Have you seen any kind of change where you're given more variety, more depth, breadth of character than when you first started out?
Yeah, it's sad to say, and it's such a... I feel like I keep harping on this, but it's not really very much difference. It's some of our, and I say this with all respect, our comedians, our clowns are very wealthy, but in terms of actors, no, there are very few roles. But I mean, but clowns have always been favorites, and they'll always be there'll always be a place for them. But for actors, no, it's who want to do more than just one thing. It's mm-hmm. It's harder, and it's and it seems to be getting harder every year. We keep looking forward to sort of other avenues, venues. I said, well, you know, when cable came out, this is going to make the big difference. I mean, we can then put our efforts into a smaller audience, to a more select group of people, or people who are interested in black actors or their stories and stuff. Well, it's been a long, hard time coming, and it still is. They're still going for the lowest common denominator, and it's still television as usual. Serious plays are very rarely done, except for August Wilson, are done on Broadway. It then means that you have a life in regional theater, and that's it.
Well, Paul Winfield, I've really enjoyed talking with you, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Marty.
Actor Paul Winfield, he portrays Judge Laron Little in the movie Presumed Innocent. He will guest star in the first 4 episodes of L.A. Law this fall. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Co-host Robert Siegel has joined us. What do you have for the news for us, Robert?
Well, today, Marty, we have news of President Bush's on-again, off-again position about raising tax rates for the highest income households in America. Today, he's on again. He says he would accept higher tax rates together with a lower tax for capital gains. We'll hear more about that later. Also, we'll be hearing about the Nobel laureate for literature, Octavio Paz, and some poems written by famous writers long before they were famous, in fact, when they were 14, 15, sometimes 11 years old, and the latest in the Persian Gulf crisis.
Okay, Robert, thank you. Those stories and more are coming up from All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The quest to reach a compromise on the new federal budget is going on even as we speak. Last weekend, tourists got a taste of federal bankruptcy from Pearl Harbor to the Statue of Liberty. Commentator Maureen Corrigan, who lives in Washington, D.C., says the situation made it difficult to be a good host.
This past Columbus Day weekend, friends of mine from New Jersey came to visit, along with their 3 daughters, ages 9, 7, and 5. Besides the mandatory trip to the zoo to see the smelly pandas, we'd planned to take the kids to the Lincoln Memorial and the White House. They've only seen replicas of these places in Disneyland. We wanted to show them that the real statue of Abe Lincoln doesn't sit across from Mr. Toad's wild ride. We wanted them to appreciate the difference between fantasy and history. But at 12:01 this Saturday morning, fantasy merged with reality when the U.S. government supposedly went broke. So the kids wound up having a strange kind of history lesson. They saw our nation's capital all locked up. Washington itself was transformed into one big monument to the confusion of our representatives, the petulance of our president, and our own lazy indifference to government. On Saturday morning, none of us could believe that all the museums and parks in Washington had been shut down, so we drove to the Washington Monument. It was closed, all right. We started walking along the mall towards the Capitol. We passed the Museum of American History, closed. The National Gallery, closed. The Air and Space Museum, the Aquarium, the Smithsonian Castle, all closed. Towards mid-afternoon, I began to miss something else about these museums besides their exhibits, namely their indoor plumbing. A line from Virginia Woolf's essay, A Room of One's Own, popped into my head. Woolf is criticizing the exclusionary tradition of male literature, and she says, I thought how unpleasant it is to be locked out, and how it is worse, perhaps, to be locked in. I've always liked that line, but now I realize that the woman who wrote it had never been locked out of a museum bathroom with three kids who'd been drinking Coke all morning. Lots of other tourists looked uncomfortable, too. We saw some diving into bushes along the mall, and we were heading into a leafy clump ourselves when one of the girls spotted a crowd of people swarming up the steps of the Capitol. It was like a scene from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. We, the people, had finally been roused by our kidneys to converge on the only open tourist site in town. As a bonus, maybe we'd all find out now what our legislators were doing about this budget mess. The girls, their parents, and I stepped into an elevator going up to the House floor. And who was inside but Congressman Ron Dellums from California? He was resplendent in white tie and tails. I can't miss my son's wedding, he told us as he dashed off. Well, I guess he had a good excuse, but where were his colleagues? Only two congressmen were debating the budget issue inside the House chamber. It was all pretty depressing and hard to explain to the kids. As we left the Capitol, the 5-year-old, Deirdre, asked me if the president could close down Disneyland, too. No, I told her. Mickey Mouse is too smart to let Disneyland go down the toilet like this. Wrong choice of words. We had to go back inside and wait for another half hour on the most popular line in town.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Today's show was produced by Fred Lannerl. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk books and politics with Mario Vargas Llosa. He's one of South America's leading writers, and he says he's relieved that he lost his bid for the presidency of Peru. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff on the restored version of Disney's animation masterpiece, Fantasia. That and more next time on Fresh Air.